Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth.
PEN America stands at the intersection of free expression and literature. And what that means is that PEN does not believe that literary culture can thrive unless writers and readers can write freely, think freely, and share ideas freely. We are a membership organization, so our membership helps us do the work that we do. If you want to hear more about what PEN does or read more about what PEN does, please visit us at PEN.org. Now, you're in for a dynamic conversation tonight, and I just want to tell you a little bit about our speakers. Dr. Tiffany Crutcher is a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was thrust... into the national spotlight following the death of her twin brother, Terrence, who was shot by a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma, while holding his hands in the air. The murder of her brother compelled Tiffany to speak out against police brutality, particularly the killing of unarmed black men. She has chosen to turn her personal tragedy into an opportunity to bridge fear and mistrust and help transform a justice system that has continually perpetrated injustice dating back to 1921, the Tulsa Race Massacre, where mobs of white rioters burned down her great-grandmother's community known as Black Wall Street. Dr. Crutcher has remained committed to organizing coalitions throughout the country that promote the interests of minority communities. She is the founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation and the Demanding a Justice Tulsa Coalition. The foundation's primary focus is criminal justice and policing reform, providing scholarships to African-American students, communities, youth development, and policy advocacy. Our other featured speaker today is Onika Asoma Caesar. Now, Jeff mentioned her earlier. She is the founder and owner of the Fulton Street Bookstore. She is a mother, a daughter of the Middle Passage, and a true Enneagram 8. She is the owner, as I mentioned before, of Fulton Street Books and Coffee here in Tulsa. I went today. It is fantastic. It's wonderful, curated. It's a beautiful communal space. And it's a space that centers the stories and narratives and lived experiences of black, indigenous, people of color. She believes in literacy has liberation and is proud to be your local book dealer. Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter covering racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine and the creator of the landmark 1619 Project. Prior to joining the New York Times, Nicole worked as an investigative reporter at ProPublica in New York City, where she spent 3 years chronicling the ways official policy created and maintained segregation in housing and schools. Nicole started her journalism career covering the majority black Durham public schools for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. During her 3 years there, she wrote extensively on issues of race, class, schooling, and equity. Now, before we begin, and I invite the speakers to the stage, I want us to take a moment of reflection. On this day, 101 years ago, at the historic Booker T. Washington High School in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, students and teachers were preparing for the school's prom. Now, that prom never happened, because on that night, the Greenwood community was destroyed by the worst demonstration of racial violence in this country's history. I ask that you please join me for a moment of silence for all the lives lost, and communal connections destroyed during this devastating act of anti-blackness. All right. Thank you. Now let's bring the speakers to the stage.
Good evening, Tulsa. Greenwood by Jasmine Mann. The whistle of an unnatural wind gave word there would be a lynching of a Negro boy who shined shoes. Not a rapist, just a boy. A child boy, a teenage boy, 19-year-old boy still fresh in his days, and a wind that would not know the enormity of its crime until morning-filled air with turpentine, an invasion led by Klansmen, a hate that would outdo itself to a menacing ritual of fire, wood, and blood. The bombs turned clouds into shadows of themselves. Single-engine aircraft hovered so low, the bodies under them thought the world was ending. How could it not be? Run, Negro. 35-ish blocks in a flame that spent days burning itself tired. 300 black folks murdered into anonymity. Greenwood has a soggy, muck clay, a damp inconsistency of earth, constitution, and bone. Some buried homeless in Oaklawn, some trampled beneath the dirt. A history tucked away in attic floorboards, long enough to forget all it once was. America has a way of dancing with its own delusion. Unable to keep count of its murders because then it would have to keep count of its murders. Its good neighbors. All insurance claims denied to residents of Greenwood and black business owners of Black Wall Street and left the people holding their memory through tongue, folklore, blood, postcard, and church tale. A people chasing a memory that wasn't supposed to become a memory at all. I just want to jump right into it. I don't even want to waste any time. Can we just keep it real and speak truth tonight? So if you're ready, I need you to scream that I'm ready. Nicole, we are so glad that you're here. Why was it important to add this poem about Greenwood in the 1619 Project, and what have you learned about the community, this community, through this project?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. Very honored to be here on this particular day and to be in conversation with you both. I'm going to answer your question, but if you've watched any of my interviews, you know I just go rogue. So I'm going to go a little rogue, but I'm going to answer your question for sure. So I am in Oklahoma on this day on purpose. As states all across the country started trying to legislate against the 1619 Project and ban the 1619 Project, I decided that I wanted to go into all the places that were trying to ban us. So. Thank you. Ooh, y'all gonna be easy. Okay. Thank you. Oh, okay. Thank you. And it was important to start this here for a few reasons. So one, let me just state very clearly. Healthy societies don't ban books. Healthy societies don't ban ideas. And so it is necessary to go into the very places that are trying to suppress our history and force a confrontation with that history. And if any place understands that, it's Tulsa. Because the reason I wanted to come here is many people, as you know, found out about Tulsa by watching Watchmen.
That's true.
And thought that they were watching something fictional. And we know that in this state, school children weren't even being taught about the history of what happened in their own state. This is why the 1619 Project had to exist in the first place, right? Because we know that there's history, which is what happened on what day and who did it, and then there's history, which is what we're taught about what happened on what day and who did it. And most of us learn the history that's been manipulated, that's been managed by people in power to justify their power, and so they erase all of the things about our history that call into question the legitimacy of that power. And you can't understand Tulsa and not understand Black America, and you can't understand Tulsa and not understand America. So that's why it was important to have the story of Greenwood in the 1619 Project, because when I think of a seminal event that explains so much, particularly when we look at why do Black Americans struggle, right? Why do we have such an economic disadvantage? And what we're told, if you just watch, you know, popular culture, if you read the news, if you get a kind of common history, the manipulated history that we all get, is that somehow Black people are the only people in the history of the world who don't like nice neighborhoods, who don't want quality schools, who like crime, who won't work for what they want. Or you study history, and it all becomes very clear that the circumstances we live in are the most predictable circumstances based on the history that Black people have experienced in this country. So if you want to know why don't Black people have wealth, it's not because we didn't work for it. It's not because we didn't work harder than anyone else to get it. It's because it was systematically destroyed. Right?
Yeah.
If you want to understand, it was violently destroyed. Like, in the 1619 Project, we try to avoid euphemism in all ways. So we don't call this period Jim Crow. We call it the violently enforced, terroristically enforced period of racial apartheid, because that's what it was.
Yeah.
And Tulsa is reflective of what we saw all over the country. If you want to see the most intense violence, it was always in response to Black prosperity.
Yes.
Because Black people were not supposed to ever prosper, because prosperous meant you had independence. If you were a prosperous Black community, you stood in the face of everything that they wanted to tell us about what Black people were. And it was an affront to white people, no matter their status, because Black people weren't supposed to have success.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't tell the story of 1619 and the legacy of 1619 without telling the story of what happened here in Tulsa. And I think if you understand Tulsa, if you understand that you had a thriving Black community, and that once that wealth is destroyed, I'm going to wrap this up, or you're only going to get to ask me two questions. But I thought a lot about, so of course we all know, there were hundreds of Tulsas, right, where Black communities, particularly prosperous Black communities, were destroyed violently. And we think about when an entire community or area gets destroyed by a hurricane or some other natural disaster, we understand that that community cannot rebuild on its own. So the federal government has to come in and give a lot of funding, because when every institution is destroyed, it is impossible to bootstrap your way out of that. But when Black communities were destroyed, there was no help coming. Matter of fact, the federal government was working in concert with the local and state officials to ensure that what was lost was not only not replaced, but was stolen. So we can understand then how, when you destroy an entire district and offer no assistance, you can't dig your way out of that, no matter how hard you work, no matter how industrious you are. And that is the story of Black people all across this country. It's not a people who didn't work hard, didn't acquire wealth, didn't get land, didn't build things, even though they had nothing, but that every time they did, it was systematically destroyed and there was no help to get it back. So if we want to know, I think we're going to get to reparations, so I won't step on that.
Next question.
But This is why I had to come here. I had to come here, one, because they don't want you to learn your local history. They don't want you to learn your national history, because once you understand that history, it's like taking the red pill in the Matrix, right? You see how the system was built, and then you know the code to destroy it.
Well, I think she answered all of our questions. But before, you know, I just move on, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my father, Reverend Joey Crutcher. And you talked about, you know, this notion of having to just climb our way out of a hill. But we got some freedom fighters in the room. I want to acknowledge our District 1 City Council, Vanessa Hall Harper. Our chairwoman of the African American Affairs Commission, Ms. Christy Williams. Our national reparations expert, Dreesen Heath, with the Human Rights Watch. Our state representative, Regina Goodwin, is in the house. Our District 1 school board member, Reverend Janetti Marshall, is in the house. Former state senator and BTW alumni, Jabbar Shoemate, is in the house. Nehemiah Frank with the Black Wall Street Times is in the house. Chief Amasan, BTW alumni, is walking around somewhere, local historian, descendant. And our elders, Dale Bright, Joyce Williams, Margaret Love. And I have to give a shout out to my former teacher here, Ava Fisher, and my basketball coach, Butch Fisher. We love you. Okay, back to the regular scheduled program. So Nicole, in your New York Times article, What is Owed, you respond to every excuse made against reparations, excuses that my people didn't own slaves, and it's unfair to make people who aren't black pay for reparations. In Tulsa, we have our own reparations fight. Right now, those same excuses are being communicated by our mayor, the mayor of Tulsa, and for the native freedmen. What parallels do you see between our issues and the larger movement for reparations for the legacy of slavery?
So, one, let me just shout out all the advocates who have been working on reparations locally and nationally. The interesting thing about reparations is that is where even your most white progressive support falls off, right? So the same people who have a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard are opposed to reparations. And the polling is very clear. The majority of white Democrats, our so-called allies, are also opposed to reparations. So if you want to know what is the connection, it's anti-blackness. That is the connection. So when I wrote What is Owed, it was right after George Floyd. And I was, you know, we were allegedly in this reckoning, which of course was very fleeting because racial reckoning in America is always very fleeting. Folks get real tired real fast, that you can't turn a 400-year system in 2 weeks of protesting, and also that you might have to actually give up some shit if you, you know, want equality. So, sorry if there's some children in here, but you probably heard worse.
They did on Saturday.
Oh, I heard. I'm not going to do all that. Y'all are safe. You're safe. But what was important, so I'm watching, you know, all of this really superficial racial reckoning, like NASCAR realizing maybe you shouldn't let people fly the Confederate flag there, or Sephora saying, oh, we're going to try to have 10% of our products sold by black companies. That's all well and good, but that's superficial. Everything was superficial, right? Painting Black Lives Matter on the boulevard. And I was like, if this is really going to be the moment of racial reckoning, we have to get to the root of it, which is slavery was not a racist system, it was an economic system. Slavery, you don't transport 13 million human beings across the Atlantic just because you don't like them. You do that because you want to economically exploit these human beings for profit, and you justify that exploitation by creating racism. So as long as we can just think of slavery as racist, then we can say, well, we abolished discrimination in the law. We now have a legally equal society, so we have nothing left to do. But if you understand that slavery was a system of extracting profit, wealth from black bodies and giving that profit and wealth to white institutions and white people, and then if you understand that the 100 years that followed slavery, 100 years of violently enforced racial apartheid, was also about trying to maintain that exploitable class of labor for as long as possible, right? Jim Crow was not about racism. It was about keeping a racial hierarchy that kept black people as an exploitable class of labor, which is why black people weren't allowed to move into neighborhoods, why they weren't allowed to attend the same schools as white children, why they weren't allowed to work certain jobs. Then you understand that making equality in the law was just the beginning, that you have to do something about that 250-year economic head start and advantage that white Americans got that has left an entire race of people with almost zero wealth. So to me, to focus on policing, which matters, it obviously matters, right? Police are the enforcement arm of white supremacy, so we know that policing matters. But most of us, thank God, will not be killed by the police, but all of us will suffer from the artificial wealth poverty that we have all been forced into, nearly all of us. So anyway, I was like, in this moment of reckoning, if we're not talking about reparations, we're not actually talking about reckoning. We are losing the power of the moment. And the benefit of having studied something for 30 years almost, well, not 20, I'm not that old, is I've seen every excuse, I've seen every argument. And so when I wrote that essay, as you pointed out, I was like, I'm going to take every single argument I've heard against reparations and then using my investigative reporting lens, systematically knock it down with data and facts.
Yes, 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 yes.
So what do we know about culture? The most successful strategy against reparations has been delay until death.
That's right, that's right.
So when people say, you don't deserve reparations because there's nobody alive today who was in slavery. Well, people who were in slavery tried to get reparations. You waited till they all died, and then you said there's nobody alive. So this is what they've done, of course, with the victims of Tulsa, right? They've waited until almost everyone is gone, and then when the last three survivors are gone, they'll say, well, we don't have to pay now because there's no victims who actually experienced that. But the debt does not go away, and we all know this from the IRS, right? The debt doesn't go away with your death. And so we know that what we're seeing in Tulsa has been the template for denying black people reparations all across the country. There are living victims, of course, of racial apartheid right now, right? Our parents, many people in this room who had to live through racial apartheid. And so we're trying to wait them out as well so that we never have to pay the debt. So I think that what is critical is seeing all of the tactics for denying reparations. And this is why I ask the white folks in this room to do some soul searching about where is the opposition coming from? We know that black Americans were not given a fair chance to acquire wealth, that we were locked out of every type of program or policy, including home ownership, right? College educations that will allow you to get wealth. And we have to stop believing in this country that it's a zero-sum game, right? We can support reparations to atone for slavery, to make up for the forced wealth poverty of black Americans. And we can also have things like universal health care and student loan debt forgiveness and a living wage. Like, we're a rich country. We brag about it all the time. And one thing that I'm going rogue again. I'm about to wrap it up.
Go ahead.
One thing that we learned with the pandemic is that we can print money overnight if we want to. Right? So every excuse about, yes, reparations might be the right thing to do, but we just can't afford it. We came up with $3 trillion overnight. Right? We bailed out businesses. We bailed out folks who already had money. But when it comes to people who, as a people, black Americans are the only people in the history of the United States who had, as a people, zero wealth because of slavery, in 1865, when we finally get our liberation, we enter liberation with zero wealth, and then every time we started getting a little bit of something, that got taken away too. So why would we want to be a stingy nation that doesn't want to acknowledge, atone, and then repair? That is necessary. We can't be moral people and then just say, well, everything is equal now, so why should we have to do anything? And this is where I show all the arguments, right? There's nothing that black Americans can do on our own to eliminate 350 years of legalized racial plundering. So we go to college, we still have less wealth than white people who don't go to college. If we get married, we still have less wealth than white single moms, right? We save a higher percentage of our income than every other race, we just have less income to save. We invest more in our children's education, we just have less money to invest in their education, so they still have to take out loans, right? If we don't have children, if we do have children, if we get married, if we buy homes, none of that eliminates the racial wealth gap in a country set up on a system of racial caste. So we have to decide, are we going to be the country that we think we are? And if that's the case, we can't deny this past. And I do think that so much of the opposition to the 1619 Project, another text, is once you know the history, you can't deny the truth anymore, then you know something is owed. So instead we say, let's not learn the history because we don't want to pay that check.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to the theme of anti-blackness, because one of the things you assert in the 1619 Project is that anti-blackness essentially served to preserve slavery.
Yes.
But here we are in 2022, and anti-blackness is still going strong. We exist in a world where we have laws and policies that are race silent, but the impact of those laws and policies are not race neutral. So what does anti-blackness exist to preserve today, or what do folks believe it exists to preserve today?
That's a great question. And this is why they also don't want our children to learn critical race theory, like the real critical race theory, not the fake propaganda campaigns that places like Oklahoma have succumbed to. But what critical race theory teaches you, if you have placed a racial hierarchy into the structures of your country, in its legal system, political system, economic systems, educational system, healthcare system, for 350 years, that system still stands once you've eliminated the law. Matter of fact, you don't have to do anything. It's self-replicating. I'm going to give you a very clear example for everyone who seems so perplexed by this. It is not about individual racism, though. There's plenty of that, too. But we can just look at housing, right? The federal government creates redlining. We all heard of redlining. We think the banks did it, but the federal government created redlining. After the Great Depression, the federal government decides it wants to try to build a middle class, but of course back then the white was always silent, so they wanted to build a white middle class. And so they decided to start insuring home loans. Prior to that, if you wanted to buy a home, you had to put down between 50 to 70%, which meant most people could never buy a home. So the government decides, federal government decides, we're going to build a middle class by insuring home loans, and if we back these loans with the federal government, you only have to put down 20% on your house, and most Americans, or many Americans, could come up, white Americans could come up with that 20%. So the government decides we need to figure out which neighborhoods should we loan in, which neighborhoods would be too risky and which ones should we loan in. And so literally insurers who worked for the government sat down, got maps of the city and markers, and marked in red all black neighborhoods and any neighborhood that was integrated as well as being unlendable. This is how redlining comes to be. And so, of course, all the banks follow the redlining, as do real estate agents, because it's coming from the federal government. So between the 1930s and 1968, 98% of those home loans go to white Americans. It is the largest program that built the biggest middle class in the history of the United States was when the federal government began backing home loans, and black Americans were systematically excluded from that program. So in 1968, what happens? Anyone? 1968, we get the Fair Housing Act. How do we get the Fair Housing Act? What had to happen for us to get the Fair Housing Act? Anyone? Dr. King had to get assassinated for us to get the Fair Housing Act, because the Fair Housing Act was considered the first civil rights act for the North. So all the white congressmen who supported the 64 law, well, I guess Oklahoma was basically Jim Crow too, but Oklahoma's the South to me. But then I'm like Malcolm X, everything south of the Canadian border is the South. So the 64 Civil Rights Act, which was about public accommodations, and the Voting Rights Act of 65 were all considered to be about the South, but the Fair Housing Act was considered to be about the North, because how we accomplished segregation in the North was through housing. If you pen black people into a restricted geographic area, you don't have to segregate schools, parks, restaurants, because you go into the segregated school in your segregated neighborhood, and you go into the parks in your neighborhood, and you go into the shops in your neighborhood. So there was great northern white opposition to the Fair Housing Act, because if housing got integrated, everything got integrated, including schools. But then Dr. King gets assassinated. There's riots, or as we would call them, rebellions all across the country, and that's how they get the Fair Housing Act. So in 1968, we can no longer redline. It is now illegal. But we didn't go back and force all those people to integrate that were forced to segregate, right? We didn't go back and change home values, because what redlining did was meant the identical house in a black neighborhood was automatically worth less than the identical house in a white neighborhood. So when black people bought homes, their homes didn't appreciate. When white people bought homes, because these were white neighborhoods and we had a racialized housing system, their home prices appreciated. More wealth, more wealth, more wealth. But we don't reset housing values and say now every house that's the same is going to have the same value. So all of that just keeps accumulating, right? Those structures keep working. So now you can be a non-racist white person, but when you move into a white neighborhood, your house is going to be worth more. And if you move into a black neighborhood, all of a sudden houses start becoming worth more. This is what critical race theory tries to help us understand, right, is that all these structures can be put in place, and it's no longer about the individual, it's about systems that were set up over decades. Unless you do something drastic to dismantle those systems, the injustice is self-replicating in and of itself. And then on top of that, we still have racism. We still have banks that discriminate against black homebuyers. We still have real estate agents that discriminate against black homebuyers. So we have the structure and the individual acts. And I think that is what we all have to understand, is that it is about individual racism, but it's comforting to think it's just individuals. What is discomforting is all of the people who say they want equality, are you willing to give up that artificial, undeserved home value that you have? Are you? No, right? Are you willing to say, let's get these reparations to black folks, even though they still won't catch up with you, but somehow you think that's unfair? So this is where we get stuck, is the beauty of it, to get to what you really asked. I'm sorry, I did that whole lesson. This is my problem. So the beauty of what happened after the Civil Rights Movement is up until 1968, we had explicit racism in the law. And then after 1968 and 64, 65, 68, you no longer constitutionally can be explicitly racist, right? So then we see this embrace of colorblindness. But colorblindness in opposition to taking race into account to remedy a 350-year racist system. So now if I say, well, we need programs to target black Americans because they haven't been able to be in integrated neighborhoods, they haven't been able to get home loans, they were kept out of getting jobs, then you say that's reverse racism, right? So now we can pretend, yes, you can be colorblind now because you have a 350-year racialized system that will continue to produce racialized results, and you don't have to be explicit about it anymore. So now colorblindness is a benefit to those who want to maintain inequality. And they have adapted the language of the civil rights movement, right? This is how we all hear this one quote from Dr. King all the time, right, about content of the character, not color of the skin. But you don't want to read the rest of that speech where he talks about, you know, coming here to get our money because the government passed, a check that came back marked insufficient funds. You don't talk about that part of the speech. So colorblindness has now become dogma because it is a way to keep discrimination entrenched with a wink and a nod and say, well, we're just treating everyone equal now, though we've never had an equal society.
Yeah, 1,000%. True story. I am getting ready to refinance my home, and so I asked my white neighbor if I could borrow her family pictures so when they come and do the appraisal. Next question. Oklahoma's governor, Kevin Spitt, signed HB 1775, which prevents schools from teaching black history to our children in public schools. Essentially, anything that makes students with families uncomfortable, we can't teach it, and we know that means some families. The 1619 Project in this process has been used and weaponized for these fights. How do you respond to these attacks, and where do we go from here?
So, one, I bet many of the black and brown folks in here wish they would have had a law like that when we had to sit through school and feel uncomfortable every day, right? I mean, having to sit up there and listen to my classmates read Tom Sawyer aloud or being just completely erased from the curricula altogether. You know, I talk about this in the preface of the book that when I took my first black studies course, I became so angry because I was like, you mean we had all this history that could be taught?
Yep.
And no one thought to teach it to us. So all these years when I sat in the classroom, I felt demeaned and degraded because I assumed if black people had done something important, surely somebody would have taught
something
this
more
to
than
us.
The Bushmen.
Right?
Yep.
So how I feel about it is, in some ways, it's my greatest honor that they would be so scared of a work of historical journalism that they would seek to ban it, because powerful people don't pass laws about things that are inconsequential.
Yeah.
And what we know is that they see this as a challenge to their power, because the mythology of America is what allows them to sustain the inequality that we all experience. If we believe that we are the freest, greatest country in the history of the world, capitalism is the most liberatory economic system in the face in the history of the world, and anyone who wants to achieve success in this country can, then you can blame all the inequality on individuals and our bad choices. And it doesn't challenge power. It doesn't challenge what is probably one of the harshest systems of capitalism in the world. Because all capitalism doesn't look alike. And you can actually have capitalism like in the Western democracies in Europe that still takes care of its citizens but allows for some free markets. So to me, the fact that there is such fear that students will learn this history speaks to the power of knowledge. And that, you know, my personal hero, Ida B. Wells, said the people must know before they can act. And there is no educator like the press. And so I understand what it means to have your work suppressed in this way. And what it means is you can't suppress it. Like, Republicans have been selling lots of my books, let me be clear, right? Every time, you know, when I first pitched the project, I had what seemed like an incredibly audacious goal. I wanted Americans to know the date 1619. This date, you know, we got here before the Mayflower on the ship called the White Lion. Every American child learns about the Mayflower in 1620. But that ship that carried our ancestors, which I would argue, of course, is more important than the Mayflower for the history of the country, has been completely erased. People know that date. Even Trump supporters, you know, people who love your governor, they know 1619. They imbue that date with power when they try to suppress it. Understanding our history is powerful. They don't want us. You know, when I took that one semester class, I became an incorrigible student. Right, because you start to challenge then. When you realize, when you start to see the mythology of your nation exposed, and you start to question, well, what else have I been lied about? And you don't become so gullible. You don't just accept these lies. And then you begin to challenge, because we kind of believe the society we have is the society that we have to have. Let me be clear. The critique of the project from the left is that it was too patriotic. And never in my life have I ever been accused of that. But what I realized is black patriotism is the true patriotism in this country, right? Because it's not performative. It's not about wearing a flag pin. It's about saying we have failed to live up to our highest ideals. And we are not going to abandon our country. We're not going to abandon those ideas. We are going to fight against our own country, generation after generation after generation, to force it to live up to its highest calling, not just for us, but for every marginalized people which we have fought for. And you have to ask, why is that dangerous? Why is that dangerous? You know, I'm the face of the 1619 Project, but the book is written by some of the greatest historians in our country. Right? Harvard historians, not that we put in the Ivy that was also funded with slave money on a pedestal, but I'm just saying, very credentialed historians. And who would not want your children to read texts written by some of the greatest historians in our country? It is the fear of being supplanted as the only heroes in the story, of having to acknowledge there's a great deal of psychology. I mean, Tulsa is about psychology, right? Because it is not a good thing to destroy a prosperous neighborhood in your city. That's illogical, unless you're racist. And racism is not logical, right? So when we understand the type of psychology that has to go into a country founded on ideals of liberty, of God-given rights, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights, while you are enslaving one-fifth of your population, that takes a particular type of psychology to hold both of those opposing ideals in your head. And so the way that you hold them in your head is through denial. That's why you treat slavery as an asterisk. That's why we don't want to talk about the fact that the man who wrote the Declaration's occupation was to enslave people. The man who wrote the Constitution, enslaver. Bill of Rights, enslaver. Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, enslaver. Right? You have to deny that because it's the only way you can deal with the hypocrisy of being a country founded on ideas of liberty while practicing slavery. And just to be clear, I'm not asking any white person to feel guilty for something you did not do. But we do have to acknowledge it. We have to atone for it. And we also, to me, we have to be truthful about our history. You don't have to have a personal shame for what happened a long time ago. You can have shame for what you do now, but you don't have to have shame for what happened a long time ago. But what's always interesting to me is folks want to claim the 4th of July, though you didn't sign that document yourself, you didn't sign the Declaration, right? Your ancestors might not even have been here during the Declaration, but you claim that. You claim all that shit. You don't get to just claim the good part, right? So you may not have personally enslaved someone. Maybe your ancestors had nothing to do, you know, we're not slave owners, but you don't get to claim the Declaration, but not the fact that the man who wrote that Declaration enslaved his own children. You have to claim all of that, is all that I'm saying.
So, Nicole,
some of y'all looking a little uncomfortable. It's okay. I feel like some of y'all have never heard me talk before. It's okay. Is my security back there? Just playing.
So speaking about public schools and 1775, you've been very outspoken about your decision to send your daughter to a neighborhood public school in a low-income area.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, and have you changed your position on public schools now that all of these bills are being passed across the country?
So I'm the least optimistic person you will ever meet, and yet I have a profound hope in the power of public schools. I really do. I really do. You know, there's almost no place in American life now that the public, across class, across race, across religion, can intersect. 9 of 10 American children attend a public school, right? And it is, I believe strongly in a common good. I believe in public schools at their best in shaping citizens and giving access and giving the ability to transcend your circumstance. Now, of course, before I did 1619, most of my career was spent showing all the ways we fail to do that, right? But I believe in the power of public schools. And so when I, you know, I started my career covering school segregation, school inequality, the unfulfilled promise of Brown v. Board of Education for black children. And I remember, you know, I was a young reporter, and I would be interviewing people and activists and, you know, college professors who were all working in inequality, and all working on behalf, they said, of black children. But then you would ask them, well, where do you send your children to school? And none of them ever sent their kids to school with the kids they said they were fighting for. Like, and I just remember thinking, like, damn, that's so hypocritical. Like, how can you fight for kids that you're afraid to put your own children around? So, but I'll also say it's easy to have values when you don't have to live them, which, you know, I didn't have any kids then. So I remember being like, well, when I have kids, I'm not going to do that. And then I had a child. And I had a child in New York City, which is one of the most segregated big city school districts in the country. New York is top three most segregated cities in the country. And I would live in a poor black neighborhood. And I had to decide, was I going to live my values? And for me, it was very easy. Of course I was, because these are my neighbors. We lived in the community. I'm not afraid of our children. Now, my husband, you know, if you read the article, we had some arguments about it. We had to do some convincing because he grew up in the military. He never had the segregated school experience that's so common for black children because when you go to a base school, the school is integrated because the military doesn't allow that type of segregation on base when you can control where people go to school and where they live. And he was like, we fought hard to give our child every academic advantage that we didn't necessarily have, and now you want to give that up. And I was like, yes, I do, because I felt it was important to live our values. I think the black folks in this room will know, when you come from a low-income black community and you show some potential, right, the first thing black folks tell you is, oh, you got to get out of here. Get your education and get out of here. And so we're told as a people that success means leaving our folks behind. Success means going to white institutions, going into white neighborhoods, and abandoning our community. And it was very important for me that I don't think that's how you define success. And I actually think I would never, of course, want to go back to the period of racial apartheid. But one thing that forced segregation did was black people crossed economic classes, lived in the same area, right? So we had that type of stability that came when all your professional folks were in the same community as the maids and the janitors, right? But now, those of us who get that degree and get some success, we leave our communities. And then we wonder why they suffer. So to me, we know the help's not coming from outside. We had to save our own community. And that's why I enrolled my daughter in a segregated school, and we live in a segregated neighborhood, and I wish more of us. It's so funny because I began my journey as a school integration advocate. I still do believe that integration is the only way black children will ever get equal resources, but I also think we have to give up a lot for that sometimes. And I wasn't willing to give that up. I realized that we weren't going to integrate the New York City public schools, and so it was my job to use whatever power I could get for the benefit of our kids. And when it comes to CRT, the thing about these folks is they're really not that sophisticated, right? So, I mean, I say this is true. They tell you what they're doing. So Chris Ruffo, the architect of the critical race theory propaganda campaign, said, the overall intent is to destroy public education. So you make all these parents have no trust in public schools. You make them think their children are being indoctrinated. You make up things like, you know, the teaching force is 80% white women, and yet we're somehow to believe that all these white women were telling white children they were evil and racist. Like, that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. But by sowing all these seeds of doubt and creating this frenzy, then you get people to distrust the public schools, and then you say, well, everyone should be able to just take their money and go to whatever school they want. So let's have vouchers, and let's be able to, you know, go to private school. So it all goes hand in hand. So we have to, if we want to save public schools, and I heard y'all are on the verge of maybe going charter, is that right? Okay, I'm not going to bring that up. I'm not going to bring it up. All I'm saying is, well, everybody knows I'm opposed to charter schools because I don't believe in publicly funded private schools. So they're also anti-democratic, right? They don't have to comply with public records. They don't have to have elected school boards. They're not democratic. And you never see charter schools in rich white communities. Show me one, just one. And I've covered education for 20 years. They don't go into those communities. They go into communities like this. Okay? So, anyway, I could give a whole lecture on public schools. My point is, if you believe in strong public schools, you have to oppose anti-CRT, right? You have to oppose all privatization measures, and you also have to oppose all of this inequality that we have allowed to fester. Because the reason black parents go to these schools is because they want to have some say over the education their kids have in schools that are not, that they don't feel are educating their kids. And oftentimes the charters aren't better, but those parents feel at least they have a choice. At least they have a say. So you can't maintain inequality and then say I'm against charters. Because parents won't go to charters if they believe that they can get a quality education in their traditional public school.
That's right. So real quick, shout out to all of our public school educators. If you're an educator, stand up. Thank you all so much. And we are running out of time, and so I have one final question, and I'm going to turn it over to Anika to allow you all to get your questions answered. So this is for the black women in the room. As black women, we so often become targets of vitriol attacks. And on the same level, I feel like every black woman in the room can relate to the very public attacks you and your work endure every single day, Nicole. How do you hold all of that and keep pushing forward? And what advice do you have for a black woman like myself and for like black women in this room who are attacked every day for standing up for what's just and for what's righteous?
Thank you so much for that question. One, let me just say, I hope you know how much respect I have for you. You are such an example of what we should not have to do, but too many of us end up having to do. You shouldn't be in the position that you're in because of what this country does to black families and black people. So I can't really give advice because I feel every black woman in here knows we do what we do because we don't have a choice. And there's never a day, I mean, I'm a human being. Sometimes it's hard when you get threats, when people, you know, someone threatened to burn my mother's house down, when you're on Fox News and you get the most ugly things written to you. I have a 12-year-old who Googles me now, and she can see the things that people are saying. Yes, that's hard, but it's expected. And the beauty of studying history is understanding that you don't do this work because you think you're going to get accolades. You do this work because it's the work that you're called to do. I talk a lot about my grandmother, Arlena Tillman. You shared your Mississippi background. My grandmother was born on a cotton plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi.
as was my father. And they were born into a family of sharecroppers. My grandmother had a fourth grade education. And when my father was 2 years old, she decided her children were not going to pick cotton like she had, like her parents had, like her grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents had. And she got on a train to Illinois Central with a box of cold fried chicken that her mother had fried for her and her two young children. And the train was going to Chicago, but I always say we were so country, we got off the train too early and ended up in Waterloo, Iowa somehow. But this black woman with a fourth grade education was determined to change the trajectory of her family's life. And she never got to see what I became. She never got to see what her resolve not to raise her children in the feudal South would do. But every day I work in service of the debt that I can't repay to her. And so I don't ever struggle. I never lack for motivation because I know to whom I belong, my personal ancestors, my collective ancestors, and these folks have no idea what motivates someone like us. So they don't know how to destroy us because they don't know why we do what we do.
Thank you. That's a word. That's a whole word. So many of you had the opportunity when you came in to write questions on these cards. I'm a first grade teacher. I was able to read all of them. And we don't have a lot of time, so I think we may have time for two. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in with two. The first question is young professionals who are recent graduates or starting their careers, for the young folks who are about to venture out into the world, how would you encourage them to approach these discussions and this work as we follow your work in scholarship?
That's a great question. Who asked that? What's your profession? Okay, so first of all, can we give a round of applause? Proud of you. Proud of you. So, you know, it's hard for me to give advice that'll be specific enough to be helpful. What I'll say is you can't teach what you don't know. So the biggest part to me is spending as much time trying to soak in and learn as much as you can. And it's not your job necessarily to educate everyone else, right? Unless you choose to. I feel like we often get put in positions where we have to be the spokesperson or, you know, we get added on to DEI work even though that's not actually our job and we're not getting compensated for it. So I feel like, you know, when you feel like educating, you do, and when you don't, you don't. But the advice that I give to young folks, and this is as someone who's clearly no longer young, is that you can only control that which is in your sphere of control, which is yourself. You can't control how people are going to perceive you. You can't control how people are going to treat you. If anything could be gleaned from what happened with my tenure debacle at the University of North Carolina last year, is you can do everything these folks tell you to do, get every credential, get every honor, and they'll just change the rules at the end, right? We know that. So you can't be worried about that. One thing that I knew, though, is they couldn't deny me for anything that I didn't do or did do, right? But I can control my own excellence, and that's all that I could control. So as you go out and start your career, trust me, it doesn't matter what field you're in, we all face the same struggle. It's going to be a struggle. But control what you can control. It doesn't mean you'll make it where you're trying to make it necessarily. See, I don't give an uplifting talk. I try to be real. There's a lot of folks that were as smart or smarter than me, as ambitious as me or more, who didn't make it where I am. But at least if you don't, you know it's not because of anything that you could control that you didn't do. And you can't worry about folks outside of yourself.
Uh, All right, we have our final question of the evening. And before I ask this question, I want to acknowledge that at the beginning we took a moment of silence. And a lot of folks are saying, yes, let's continue to take these moments of silence, but also ensure that you are taking a moment of action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage everyone that's here tonight, when you leave, before you leave, before you go to bed, early in the morning, whenever it is, that you decide to take a moment of action, whether it's donating to organizations that are doing the work, like the Terrence Crutcher Family Foundation, whether it is educating yourself and reading literature like the 1619 Project, whether it's following folks on social media like Nate Morris, who will be sure to give you an action item and tell you who to call, make sure you are taking a moment of action. I also realize that as much as people believe that we enjoy talking about race and disparity and inequity, and as much as people like to say that we enjoy being divisive, that this is also heavy. And so the question is about hope, right? In light of all this, what makes you hopeful?
Who asked that?
Mike Sherman.
Okay. Thank you for asking. I was going to say that's a presumptuous question, but I won't say that. So, you know, I often get this question, and I know exactly where the question is coming from, so I'm going to respect where the question is coming from. Because I do realize that while I personally am not a hopeful person, I don't find hope useful. I'm more of a rage-motivated person. But I do understand that if people don't feel hope, then people don't feel motivated or the necessity to act, right? You have to believe, even though I don't believe we're ever going to be right in this country, you have to believe that we can dismantle these systems, or why are we here, right? What are we working towards? And so I really go back and forth between feeling completely hopeless, that nothing will ever change, and then realizing there were folks like, you know, in 1855, Frederick Douglass could not have imagined that the institution of slavery could come to an end in a decade, right? That would have been ludicrous to think you could topple the slave state. But it did, right? And then you think about someone like Fannie Lou Hamer or Rosa Parks or Diane Nash, who couldn't have believed. It would have been nonsensical to believe you could end racial apartheid by law in this country, 100 years of that. And yet they had to believe they could do it, or what were they fighting for? So I go back and forth between not having personal hope, but realizing you can't give talks and ask people to go out and do some shit and then tell them that it's hopeless, probably not effective. So this is what I'll say. I think that hope has to be an action. And hope without action to me is useless. So when I think about all those people I just named, they didn't just sit and hope that society was going to change. They got out and made it change, right? Often at great personal risk to themselves. So we absolutely, the beauty of reading the 1619 Project or any of the hundreds of underlying texts is you realize that everything we see has been created. It was all intentionally architected. None of it's natural. None of it's inevitable. So if you understand that, then you know we can deconstruct everything in our society that we don't like. But that's going to be some hard work. And that's going to mean actually putting some skin in the game and not just coming to my talk and self-flagellating because I'm being mean, but like actually doing something. So nothing gives me hope except my child. But I do believe that we have to believe that the impossible can be made possible, because it has been made possible. But it's going to mean a bunch of very good people, very nice people who are presently doing nothing, have to turn that nothing and that hope into an action. Thank you for your question.
Where's Shada Brown? You got your action question answered. Last question, inquiring minds want to know, because this event was hosted by two amazing bookstores, Magic City Books and Fulton Street Books and Coffee. What are you reading outside of history? And what do you like to do for fun? Last question.
Thank you for that. Because actually, yeah, all I really do read is history almost. My mom, 2 years ago, I asked for the four-part LBJ biography set. And my mom was like, you need to lighten the hell up. Like, nobody asked for that. Nobody asked for that for Christmas. And so she got me Number One Lady Detective Agency instead, which is actually quite great. So what I've started doing, because I really do love fiction, but I always feel like I don't have time to spend on fiction because I always feel like if I'm reading, I need to be learning some more facts to wield against the country. But I just finished, so I started listening to books on audio while I'm out walking and things like that, because then I feel like I can't be reading history because I need to outline the books. So I just finished, it's one of the best books I've read, but it's like two Bibles thick, The Love Song of W.E.B. Du Bois. Have any of y'all read that? I'm telling you, it was 26 hours on Audible, okay? It was very long, but it's so good. And then I just started Mothers on Audible, so I highly recommend it. And then what do I do for fun? I'm a very fun-loving person, in case y'all didn't know. So I like to drink too much bourbon.
That's my favorite.
About to drink some when I leave here tonight. And I love to throw parties. And, one thing that is always good to remember, the 1619 Project, most of it is very heavy, very hard, very depressing. But also, through all of this, through the worst of circumstances, we've found joy, love, happiness. We created, right, like the backbone of American culture is all black. First American literature was the slave narrative. Only original American music, right, is gospel, jazz, hip-hop, and blues. We created culture. And so it's always good to remind ourselves that we have to nourish our souls, nourish our humanity so that we can go out and keep fighting. And I think that's very important. It is those moments of joy that we all find, even in the most horrific of circumstances, that sustain us to go out and fight for the liberation of our people and all people.
It's never enough time, but give it up, everybody. Nicole Hannah Jones, Onika Asamoah-Caesar. Thank you all so much.
So this morning what we're going to talk about, I guess I can call it shampoo. Okay? Now all of you know that when you're going to go down, you're going to go down and clean your carpeting. You go down to the store and you get the machine and you go in and buy a little thing called shampoo to clean the carpet. And what shampoo does is really it takes the sham out and leaves the poo in. Okay? And that's what's been going on through history with black folk. They keep taking the sham out and leaving the poo in. So this morning, we're going to do a little shampooing, okay? And we're going to start off, and I'm going to show you, take you right through history again, through a second segment of history, and we're going to start dealing with some of the issues about reparations. And everything I tell you must be taken in that context if you really, truly are going to understand the nature of reparations. That's the only way you're going to do it. You must understand the nature of it. And what it's saying is this, what I'm saying to you, is that reparations is not a nicety. It's not something nice to have for black folk. It is now an absolute necessity. If you do not get reparations soon, black folk, as I told you before, are through. Reparation is not a nicety, it's a necessity. Now, I first wrote my book, Black Labor, White Wealth. That's what I was telling you then. That's been 7 years ago. when I wrote the first affirmative action plan in the United States in 1971 that Jeb Bush just killed in Florida, as you all been reading about in the paper. I wrote that plan in 1971 as reparations for black folk. And nobody was giving anything to black folk for reparations at that time, but it was killed off within 6 months. It was converted to things for minority, women, children, gay, handicapped, midgets, humpbacks, everybody else. Everybody but black folk. And it was diluted down and black folk got nothing out of it. So affirmative action was dead 6 months after I put it on the floor. But now they've been given the pretense that somehow they've had affirmative action all these years. And they haven't had anything for black folk. Black folk haven't gotten anything out of affirmative action. And so in a way, I'm glad that affirmative action is now dead. I want them to bury it, you know, and throw flowers, commemorate, and let it go. And I want black folks to go to reparations. Because that's the only way. You got to have reparations. There's no other choice. You got to have reparations. And that's what I'm going to be talking about this morning. But also I'm going to try to show you in my little discussion with you is all the things I want you to be aware of, the tricks and the games. That's why I'm going to pick a certain part of history to show you the games. And you all take your little notes and try to remember these things. So when you see the same games reoccurring all the time, you know what the game is, what they're up to. And so that's what we'll be talking about, reparations for black folk. Now let's start talking about reparations for black folk. And let's pick a point. Let's take Juneteenth, since this is Juneteenth weekend, the Juneteenth celebration. Now, I talked to you earlier about the importance of culture. So we have to have Juneteenth as a culture process because we don't have any culture. And so when you hear me criticize Juneteenth in a few seconds, it's not because I want you all to disassociate or discontinue celebrating Juneteenth. It's just I want you to do it in the right light and the right tone so you understand what the games are. It's just like if I were to start talking about Kwanzaa right now. I don't want you all not to celebrate Kwanzaa because we have to have culture. We don't have any culture. The culture we used to have, white stole it from you. All your culture has been stolen and exploited by everybody else. See, you, right now, your culture in this country, your major contribution would have been your genius. See, black folk have a genius for creating music, dance, language, slang, you see, art. And even the way we wear our clothes, that was our culture. But everybody has taken the exploit and gotten rich off it. Every time you come up with anything, they take it from you because you integrate. You see, one time, Dixieland music was black. You see, jazz was black. Gospel was black. Blues was black. Rhythm was black. Now they got your music. That is a $103 billion a year industry, and black folk get less than 1% out of it. You see, even the Hispanics got your music now. They take African music and mix it with black music and call it Latin beat. See, everybody makes money off of black folk. Because when you integrate it, you open yourself up. Integration means filleting yourself, saying, come get whatever you want. When you integrate, they went inside and took everything out and left you with nothing. And that's why you cannot make it under the integration process. Nobody else opens themselves up like I said, come get what you want, take it, and make a living off of it. That's why now they have a rock and roll, you know, museum for whites and call Elvis Presley the king of rock. Or rock and roll, because it used to be rhythm and blues until white folks discovered it. See, they discovered black music like they discovered America. And then once they discovered it, then they became theirs. And we just gave it to them. So we got to have culture. And if I were talking about Kwanzaa, see, friend, I would tell black folks, so you got to understand that we got to have Kwanzaa. Because Kwanzaa gives us something to celebrate at Christmas other than the white form of Christmas celebrating. But Kwanzaa comes out of Swahili. And Swahili is a fabricated language. That's not a real language. It's a fabricated language that was created by the initial, original slave traders. And that was Arabs. See, Arabs started Swahili. They started Swahili intentionally to be able to communicate with Africans, black Africans. And so that's a fabricated language. So if we talk about we're going to avoid the white man's language and run over to start dealing with Swahili and dealing with the Arab language, see, you just jump from the fire into the frying pan. Doesn't make any difference one way or the other. But again, we need the celebration, but you need to understand that. Now, the same thing is true with Juneteenth. And see, all this will give you the context for reparations now so you understand the issues. See, Juneteenth, the same thing. See, Juneteenth started off as a major celebration in Galveston, Texas in 1865. It's where when black folk finally got the word, the last ones in the country to get the word, that they were free. You see? And they went out and started celebrating, and we passed it on down, you know, through the South and the Southwest up to this point as a major day for celebrating. But in reality, what you're going to find out in a few minutes is that you have never been free. They never gave you your freedom. The freedom and what they, and the little game going on behind the whole thing about emancipation and also about Juneteenth, and we're going to figure out what it is. So we start getting our reparations, we're going to get it the right way. Now, let's go back now. See, let's go back to two. Let's take Juneteenth as a kickoff point, since this is Juneteenth weekend. You go back now to, let's say, about 1860, when Abraham Lincoln, the so-called great emancipator that you all will be celebrating over Juneteenth, the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, President Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln didn't do one single solitary thing positive for black folk. One of the biggest scoundrels and culprits ever lived in terms of black folks. So you start talking about celebrating Juneteenth and Abraham Lincoln, you got to see that you can be deal a double deck. You're back to the shampoo again. See, you're back to, you start talking about great emancipator and how he freed the slaves. There goes the shampoo. Because you see, and that's what happened in 1963. We had the great Martin Luther King March, and I had a dream speech. See, where did they go to give that speech? But at the foot of the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. They stood at his feet and said, I got a dream with Abraham Lincoln standing behind you. He was one of the biggest scoundrels to black folk on earth. And even when our friends, the Farrakhan, when he had the Million Man March. You see, because they don't have the truth. They don't know some of the similes they get caught in. So they didn't go to the foot of the great emancipator and sit at the foot of Abraham Lincoln and give the Million Man March speech. You see, and whether it's Martin Luther King or Farrakhan or our people, we keep getting tricked because we don't understand what's going on. Now, if you go back to 1860, Abraham Lincoln had absolutely no interest in black folk. No interest in black folk. His interest was a very simple thing. All he wanted to do, as a matter of fact, every speech he gave in my research shows that what he said is that I can't stand black folk. I don't need black folk. Don't want black folk. And what I would ideally like to do is to recolonize black folk and ship black folk out of the country. I would like to ship them either to Latin America, Central America, or back to Africa just to get rid of them. And see, and that's what he wanted to do in 1860. But you see, he couldn't do it because he checked around trying to figure out how he could do it after he became president. He found out something, which is a point that you all got to remember because we're going to talk about these things later. He found out that white folk needed these black folk they couldn't stand. See, they needed them. They needed poor black folk because, see, no white person wanted to do the dirty, nasty, dangerous work. So black folk then were needed as a labor class, point one. They needed your labor. The second group that came to Lincoln, the great emancipator that we like to worship in Washington, D.C., was a group of merchants, all the merchants, all over the country. You had people like all the people tied into the textile industry, the cotton industry, the insurance industry, the sugar industry, the tobacco industry, the rice industry, the indigo industry. See, all those people came and said, no, you can't get rid of those black folk. Because you see, also, because people like us in the cotton industry and the leather industry, we need them as consumers. We need them as consumers. We need those blacks that you call darkies as consumers. Because right now, look, we know we got 5 million of them, and I know that every year, every slave owner is going to buy two pair of clothes for them, a pair of summer clothes and a pair of winter clothes, and those clothes are made out of what we call nigger cotton. That's the roughest part of the cotton that nobody else could wear. It's rough, tough, it's just almost so rough it takes the skin off the body. But that's what they made the clothes off of. So you had whites who had these industries. All they did was make what they called nigger clothes for slaves. They knew they had that market. And the same thing with the leather industry. They knew it was from the leather industry that every slave would get two pair of shoes a year. They would give them a pair of sandals and a pair of brogans. Okay? And so they knew that was so a white leather maker said, hey, I know for a fact I'm gonna sell 5 million pair of sandals and 5 million pair of brogans every year. That is a built-in lock market. I got black folks as a lock consumer market. So I got black folks trapped two ways. One, You see, as I told you a few minutes ago, is because we need their labor, and secondly, we need them as consumers. And that's the only way they didn't send blacks out of the country. They had one other third reason that popped up, and they tried to deal with it through Lincoln, was that the white slave owners said, but on the other hand, they said, don't you know we've invested something like $8 billion? That we got more money invested in slaves than we got in all the businesses in the United States and all levels of government put together. The biggest form of investment in the United States was money invested in slaves. And they didn't want to lose that money. And so what Lincoln did to try to resolve that, he says, well, what I'll do is that let me give you all some reparations. And if I decide to send them out of the country, I'll give you some reparations. So he sent a bill over to Congress to give reparations to white slave owners, saying if you all were free to slaves, I'll give you reparations for it. And the only place they got it was in Washington, D.C., which in Washington, D.C. just happened to be the slave capital of the world at that time. And so in Washington, D.C., it went through where they awarded something like $300 for every black slave that was released by a white owner. And that was reparation for whites. Now the whole context is set. So people say, well, the war started now. What are you going to do with all these blacks? So we go from about 1861 to about 1862. Now, remember I just told you these points now about they needed blacks for labor and consumer, and they wanted reparations. Remember those three points. Now, here comes 1862. In 1862, we're into a war, and the North is losing the war. The South is beating the devil out of the North. The South is beating the devil out of the North. There was no way that the North could win the war. No way they could win it. They couldn't win it for some very simple facts. Fact one, they couldn't win it because the South had all the wealth. The South had all the wealth. The North did not have any wealth. The North was a poor area of the country. They didn't have any money. Because, see, slavery, I just told you, you had $8 billion just in black slaves alone. And a white person in the South who owned any slaves had a massive amount of money over Northern. As a matter of fact, a white person in the South who had what we call a gang plantation, we use gang slavery, he had 400 times the wealth of a typical Northern white. A white man in the South with two slaves had more money than the average white male in the North by throwing his family, his home, his wagons, animals, business, anything else thrown together. That's where all your wealth was. A black person, a black slave, was a walking American Express card. Every white person could make a living just by having one slave. All they do is put him up in the morning, send him out to work, and go back to bed, wait for him to come home in the evening, and take the money from him and get paid for it. It was called rent a slave. They buy slaves and rent them, and rent them out to other people up and down the road to use them. So everybody understood that. That was the name of the game, is that you got to have and own some black slaves. Now, so what we did, and so by 18, so the North couldn't win. So the North said, we got to have a plan. We got to have a plan so that the North could beat the South. Now, see, nobody's talked about freeing any slaves. Don't y'all get off on the wrong point. Nobody's talking about freeing any black folk. So now we're up to about 1862. All of a sudden, a couple of generals around Lincoln said, look, we're losing this war. We're losing the war. We're getting the devil beat out of us. What can we do? Lincoln said, I don't know. They said, I'll tell you what, we got a scheme. Why don't we play some games, play some trickery? Let's use a little shampoo. What we'll do is, let's turn around and put out the word that you're going to free the slaves. If you put out the word that you're going to free the slaves, what would that do to the South? See, first of all, that would create all kind of havoc for them. Because, you see, the reason they're beating us is because they got 5 million blacks there on their team in the South. You got 5 million black slaves in the South that are taking care of the white families, taking care of the yards, the garden, the food, the white families, protecting them, feeding them and clothing them and doing all the work while all the white men out fighting the war. Are y'all following me? So the South is using blacks to build the highways, the bridges, the railroads, to haul and run the wagons and haul all the supplies, to work at the factories and the mines and the timber yards, to build the bridges, being done by black folk, so that way all the white men in the South would go out and fight the war. So at about September the 22nd, About September 22nd, about 1862, that Lincoln then announced his intentions of freeing the slaves. He said, I'm going to free the slaves. Let's see what the South would do. And then a general said, well, let's not put out anything in writing until we get a major political victory, whether it's Vicksburg or Gettysburg or something. And then we got something really to piggyback on and announce that you're really going to do it. And so that way, and if we go ahead and do it, maybe that'll really be a big incentive. So that was in September, about September 22nd, 1862. The word went out. The South was very leery about whether or not the North's going to free these slaves. And so then come about January the 1st, 1863, he then said, well, what we're going to do is that we're still losing the war, so let's then just wait. And so they decided to wait, so let's wait a few years because they're losing the war. But the generals had picked up the fact that he was going to free the slaves. So a guy like General William Tecumseh Sherman, he's in now fighting in the South. So he says, well, I'm going to take that up and follow through with it. Let's go ahead and do it because I'm a general. I'm fighting down here, not the president. I'm fighting. And if we can destroy the South by tricking them and thinking we got to free the slaves, let's do it. So then he came up with this whole thing about let's take the land, all the confiscated land, and the property from these white plantation owners. If we take over a plantation, let's take it. Now let's take them and divide it up and give 40 acres and a mule to every black. And let's give every black 40 acres of mule. And that way, even if Lincoln hasn't moved, we can still do something to devastate the South emotionally. And so Tecumseh Sherman then says, all the land I take from these white plantation owners, I'm going to give it to black folk. And he goes over and sets aside a long strip of land running from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way down to Jacksonville, Florida, and all those islands off the coast there. He says, that's going to belong to black folk. That black folk are going to own all that land from South Carolina all the way down to the top of Florida. And they're going to own all the islands. He says, I'm going to give that to them. And as soon as he set it up to do it, guess who called him in shortly after that, maybe a few months or a year after, whenever he started, maybe about a year after, because a lot of blacks got over there and got the land. A lot of blacks did get on those islands. If you go and some of those islands that you all go over and watch now was like Hilton Head. See, Hilton Head Island was all black. See, blacks went over there and got Hilton Head. And some of them got guns and said, you ain't going to take nothing from us. And also John's Island became all black. And also Amelia Island off the coast of Florida, Jacksonville, Florida, became all black. But see, nowadays they're no longer black because whites have taken them back now and made them into luxury islands for whites. But blacks took those islands, all up down that coast, and took that land under Sherman's order, about 40 acres and a mule. And now, about a year after that, our esteemed emancipator of black folk jumped in and said, you can't do that. Take back that order and force Sherman to kill the program, to not give black folks any land. Your great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, says blacks don't get any land. And a lot of blacks already had that land over there, and whites went in and tried to take it away from them later on. So the great emancipator started whizzing around. And that was about 1864 now. Now we come to about 1865. Now what he said, now at this point in time, he's going to put out what we call the Emancipation Proclamation. So he put out the Emancipation Proclamation, but the Emancipation Proclamation took effect as of January 1, 1863. He expected black folk to come out and celebrate that so he can get the South all riled up by the blacks being free, even though he knew black folk, in fact, would not be free. He put that out on January the 1st. But nobody bought into it, and blacks didn't come out to celebrate. Did I say 1863? I mean 1865. That thing came out, was announced at that time. But here's what happened, though. When the word got out, and black folk didn't come out on January 1st because, see, my people won't come out in the wintertime to celebrate anything. See, that's too cold. So black folk didn't come out. Black folk didn't come out. So the Emancipation Proclamation then was sort of postponed. It was written for that point in time, enacted at that point in time. The word didn't get down until about May about May 18th, they picked it up in where public officials in the South says blacks are free. And most people got the word in May that black folk were free. It didn't get to Texas, the Galveston, Texas, until June 19th that black folk were supposedly free. Now, y'all following that sequence for me? Okay. So all that's been moving across the country, saying that black folk are now free. But let me go back now behind this little game. They did not want to free blacks, as I said to you a few minutes ago. What they wanted to do was to disorganize the South by giving the pretense that somehow black folk were free. So here's what your good esteemed President Abraham Lincoln did. In the Emancipation Proclamation, what he said was this: I now hereby declare all the blacks who are in the Confederacy as slaves as now being free. Now, listen to his logic. He's in the North with the Union, and the South is the Confederacy, and what he says is now all the blacks who are in the Confederacy, on this, the group that's broken away from the United States, y'all are free over there. Now, see, somebody's front light, that porch light was on, but nobody's upstairs at home. Now, I guess they figured the whole world was stupid. If you, in fact, if they've broken away from you and that's your enemy you're fighting, how are you going to free somebody that you don't have any control over? So they had no control over those people. So he didn't free anybody in the Confederacy. He did not free that order, the Emancipation Proclamation, did not free any slaves, because the slaves he was talking about weren't even in the Union up north. They were in the South, so he didn't free them. Now, he could have freed some slaves if he wanted to, because we had all these other slaveholding states in the North, the border states, Kentucky and Tennessee and all the rest of them around in Maryland. But he didn't touch those states. He didn't touch those states. He didn't touch the states that he could have, where he could have freed slaves. He didn't. Where he couldn't free slaves, he gave the pretense that he could. So therefore, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free anybody. And more importantly, if you go back and read the Emancipation Proclamation, also what he did in the Emancipation Proclamation, trying to be slick again as a president, he put in the proclamation that any states or any whites in the slaveholding states, if you decide to come back into the Union, join us in the North, you can continue to hold your slaves. Now, let me give that to you again, since you all probably missed that. I'm going to give it to you again. Also, he had in the proclamation that even though I know, now he didn't say that he knew it, but the slaves who were in the South, in those southern states, he didn't free them. But he said, though, if any of you states decide to come back in and rejoin the Union, because my whole intent is to maintain the Union, you can continue to hold your slaves. And that way, the bottom line would have been that whites would have still had slaves in the North and they still had slaves in the South. That was the logic. They didn't free anybody, but it gave the pretense of freeing black folk, and black folk were happy all over the country. Because, see, most of them couldn't read the Emancipation Proclamation. They couldn't figure all this out. So they started dancing and singing in the streets that they were free. And in fact, they didn't free not one single black any place, and gave the option to those states to come back in and get their slaves back if they wanted them. And that became the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, let's move a little faster now. So remember that. That was a shame and gam. Nobody has freed any slaves. Now here comes the end of the war. The end of the war has come, and at this point in time, since they have been running a game on everybody, and they have not freed any slaves, the first thing you got to do with the Congress is do what? Write what? What Constitution Amendment? The 13th Amendment, so they can actually, in reality, free you. So they had to write the 13th Amendment, saying that involuntary slavery is outlawed. The only way you can enslave a person is, in fact, what? What is it? If you've been duly convicted of a crime. Now, remember that, because that's going to be a very important point now. The 13th Amendment says, again, I told you how they trick you and always put in little clauses with the shamming game. So now they write the 13th Amendment. It says, black folk are now free. And the 13th Amendment was written exclusively for black folk, even though it didn't say it. It just says a nobody. And then, when you read the Constitution, you see words like nobody, all, everyone. They always use those words whenever they talk to black folks so you couldn't have a paper trail to get out of anything. So, and we got a lot of black leaders in America always use those same ambiguous words. We want everybody to be free. All people should have rights. The only people that didn't have them was black folk. See, they're scared to say black folk. And anytime you use that broad, ambiguous word, you're playing that same game they were playing back during slavery. And I keep telling our black leadership, quit trying to write things and speak broad in broad, ambiguous terms, talking about everybody, rather than talking about your own people. See, every time you start talking about... whenever you start talking about poor folk, multicultural, culturally diverse, minorities, you played a game and lost. And see, everybody, they knew that in those days. So then when they wrote the 13th Amendment, they said, now let's cut out, let's do a little more shampooing. Let's write the 13th Amendment. And this time we're going to say that this time really to God, we're really going to free them this time. And they wrote the 13th Amendment. It says that it is now constitutionally put in the Constitution that it's illegal and unconstitutional for you to commit anybody to involuntary servitude. Then they put a comma and says, except when you've been duly convicted of a crime. And you're going to figure out how the little game goes again in a few minutes, okay? So that became the 13th Amendment. Now, right after that, what happened was that they found out that most of the states says, hey, that doesn't mean anything. You didn't say black folk in particular. You used all them words, alls and everyone. And so, and we don't know what you're talking about. And plus that, since you represent the federal government, if we're the state government, you didn't say who. So as far as we're concerned, I don't care if you're talking about the Emancipation Proclamation or the 13th Amendment, we still own them, still got them. So at that point in time, the Congress stepped in. Now you had a few Republicans called radical Republicans that were committed to black folk. And they were very concerned about doing something positive for black folk beyond what the president tried to do, because Lincoln hadn't done anything for them except run a shell and pee game on them, the shampoo. So at that point, those congressmen stepped up. Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevenson and Congressman Bingaman. They said, let's do something positive. And I must tell you up front that the reason those two congressmen in particular, Stevens and Sumner, were very interested in doing something with black folk, both of them had black mistresses, you see. Even though they were white, they had black mistresses and black children. So they got up and said, we're going to have to do something for these black folk, you know. And so what Stevens got up before the Congress and said, and this is why, again, you got to remember this, when we start talking about reparations in a few seconds, what he says is that you got to do something for black folk. Contrary to all this shampooing you've been hearing from the president and everybody else, is that black people in America can only be one of two things. Either you're going to be a slave or you're going to be free. You're going to be a slave or you will be free. He says, if you do not redistribute some of the wealth, resources, power, privileges, and controls to black folks' hands, black folk will always be slaves. Now, this was said before the Congress in 1865. Stevenson and Sumner says you cannot turn black folk loose in this country. You cannot turn loose 5 million black folk, penniless, broke, no land, no clothes, no food, no animals, no land, no weapons, no tools, and no money, and say they're free. He said you're running shampoo on them. It will not work. You cannot turn them loose without giving them something. You cannot turn loose all these black folk without minimally giving them 40 acres, a mule, and $100. He picked up on what Sherman had said, General Sherman had said with the blacks off the islands of the East Coast, is that minimally, if black folk, and he said, until the day comes that you redistribute wealth and resources into these black folks' hands, they will always be slaves. And that was said in 1865. Now, based on that, they then turned around and wrote the first civil rights law in the country. It's called the Civil Rights Act of 1865. They wrote that specifically to be economic development for black folk. And in there, they talked about economics. It was economics. It had nothing to do with civil, had nothing to do with social, had nothing to do with voting, had nothing to do with getting along with people, had nothing to do with integration. What it was talking about is you had to redistribute some wealth and resources into the hands of black folk. But now that Lincoln has been assassinated, you get another scoundrel as the president. His name is Andrew Johnson. They knew what reparations was. And what you all need to know what reparations is, so that you won't get confused as things begin to develop, because reparations will be the hottest issue in this country from now on. That's what I was prophesying to you all 7 years ago, that reparations will be the hottest issue in this country. Reparations means compensation in the form of money, materials, or labor for injustices committed. That's what reparations mean. So reparations has always been economic justice. That's why my book, Black Labor, White Wealth, A Search for Power and Economic Justice, is about. That you're talking about economic justice, you talk about reparations. It means creating a structural economic inequity. So those congressmen understood that. So they asked for the 40 acres and a mule and $100. And they sent it over to Johnson, who was the new president of the United States, and he vetoed it. Saying black folk don't need anything, they're now free, quit giving them handouts. And now they're free, let them live and survive on their own. And they use a term which says, either let the ends work or starve. Okay? Now, at that point in time, they killed the bill. Now, these same congressmen came right back again later on that year and wrote the second Civil Rights Act. And that Civil Rights Act again, went through the Congress, it came out, it became the Civil Rights Act of 1866. That was the second Civil Rights Act. This time they had to tone it down some. And again, they started working the games and they were losing their power, so they had to start putting in all this all, you all, everybody, everyone, all this broad, ambiguous language again. And they passed the act again. This time they sent it over to Andrew Johnson and they overrode, he tried to veto it again, they overrode him and it went into law. That law is still on the books, called the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Now that gave black folk the only thing positive, and that wasn't that strong, but at least that was the first time they ever got anything that gave them a legal right to do anything. It was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And following that, they then said, well, we'll take that 1866 act, we're now going to convert it over to another thing called the 14th Amendment. And we're going to try to put as much of that in there as possible, because nobody still would accept black folks as being free and would do anything for a black. They say, hey, these black folks think they're free. They really think, they still think they're emancipated. They think they're free. Even though we did not give them the 40 acres and the mule, they still think they're free. And say, wait, we're going to show you how we're going to get them. Let's go back to the 13th Amendment unless we got them again. Well, the 13th Amendment says it's unconstitutional to have involuntary servitude except when duly convicted of a crime. They said, we got them again, because our people know how to play this game, this shampoo. So what they said is, now, let's now write laws called the Black Codes in 1867. And the Black Codes will criminalize black folk. And we'll put out all kind of laws to make sure we got them again. So they wrote the Black Codes throughout the South and a lot of the northern areas and forced them. And those Black Codes then says, we got you where we want you. Because all we got to do now is put out all these laws. Like, for instance, that a black person must have a signed contract to work for a white man by January the 1st of every year, or he can be arrested for being idle and vagrant. He had to have a contract in his hand that he could not be, so that tied blacks down. They create all kind of laws about blacks being guilty of looking out the same window that white folks are looking out of, or having dogs that were barking. And one of the biggest ones to get arrested of black folk for and criminalized them was called playing games with white folk. And so when they started that, now this set up a whole new system of thing. They passed those laws. And so blacks didn't get the reparations. No reparations come yet because they still shampooing everything. So now what the North says, hold it. Yes, the South has passed these black codes, but we're not going to get involved again. Because right now whites want to re-enslave black folk. Why should we get involved? They said, we got what we want. We fought the Civil War. And all these things I mentioned to you are important now when we start talking about reparations. So watch me now. We fought the Civil War. We didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. We fought the Civil War for the North. We fought the Civil War so the North could take over the wealth of the South and so they could industrialize and build industries and factories. We fought the war so the North could build factories. We fought the war so that we can take the white, whites had control of the Congress. Another thing about the three-fifths of a human being, whites were using that to control the Congress in the United States by counting blacks in the census, but not letting blacks hold in the political office. So whites got the benefit of saying, I represent all those blacks, even though they can't vote. And so whites were controlling the government. So that's what the North was fighting the Civil War for, was to take away the wealth and the control of the South, the power of the South. And so what the North says then is that you all can have those blacks now. If you want to do the black codes, fine, I don't care. They want 40 acres of mule, we're not going to give them the reparations, 40 acres of mule. And so they said, what we need now is some kind of an instrument to make sure that we need the South to be redeveloped. We got to redevelop the South, but we can't do anything to help black folk. And we don't want to hurt the North, so how do we do it? And people said, well, why do you need black folk? They said, well, we still got to have black folk to pick this cotton. See, we still got to have somebody pick the cotton. I told y'all, we still need that black labor. We still need black labor. Yes, they are so-called free on paper, but since we didn't give them the 40 acres of mule, they're still not free. We still need them. How can we use them? And so they said, we got to create an instrument that will keep black folk and yet get them, and we still need the cotton. So what they did then, they created something called the Freedmen's Bureau in 1868. The Freedmen's Bureau is what later on created all of our black universities. And what they did, they took the Freedmen's Bureau and set up a special commission that would go around through the South and supposedly, in quotes, to help black folk. And the Congress appropriated some money for them. And what they were sort of been doing then was trying to give black folk a little bit of food, a little bit of so-called minimum welfare, and to help them prepare to be free. But what they decided to do was to use the Freedmen's Bureau in a very slick scheme again to re-enslave black folk. And what they did then is they came up with a whole scheme saying, we still need black folks' labor. So the Freedmen's Bureau then set up a thing called a contract system, where they drew up a little contract, which if a black person signed it, it tied him to the first spot. See, nobody put his name in the first spot with an X and tied him into the white man at the South. Okay? And the Freedmen's Bureau went all throughout the South, said they're going to do it in such a way where because the whites in the North needed cotton. Still needed cotton. Even though they destroyed the South, they moved all those factories and all the cotton from the South to the North. And now the North got all the plants in the South, and they needed factories. And at that point in time, in the late 1860s, over 60% of all this country's export and wealth was in cotton. They were still shipping cotton out. And they need to sell cotton because like England was buying something like 1 billion pounds a year. And they needed that cotton, but they didn't, and they could have solved a racial problem at that point in time by just simply saying, if we need cotton and we need cotton production, why don't we give the 40 acres and a mule to the black people and let them raise the cotton and buy it from them? You know, if the country needs cotton to survive, because that's our major industry, why don't we give land, mules, and money to black folk, let them raise the cotton and buy it from them? And see, the racism in this country was so acute and so strong, they said, don't give them anything. What you do is to go around and sign up the contract and make them work for whites, and we'll buy it from whites. And almost every state in the United States then passed laws saying that black folk couldn't even raise some of this cotton and tobacco. They took the Freedmen's Bureau in 1868 and said, look, what we're going to do now is that we got to figure out a way not to give these black folk 40 acres of mule and no reparations. And they set up the Freedmen's Bureau and said, go get them a signed contract. Because, yes, we can go give black folk 40 acres of mule and still get our cotton, but we don't want black folk to have any wealth and power. No wealth and power for them. So what they did, and after about 3 years, the Freedmen's Bureau went throughout the South, signed up every black person, every black farmer, every black family to contracts. Those contracts then locked black folk into what you call sharecropping and peonage. Locked them in, and not only did it lock them in, but here's what it did to them. Locked them in, but what it did when it locked them in, they told them that was voluntary for blacks to sign it. But if he couldn't sign it, he would get no welfare, no food, nothing else. And once he signed those contracts, he gave away all of his rights again. See, now he had no right to quit. He had no right to protest a contest. He could not strike. He could not demand higher wages. And in that contract, what it told him in the sharecropping was that if you, in fact, would go back and work for your same white master that you used to work for and sign a contract with him, that if you work with him, he'll give you the seeds and the animals. He'll let you use his land. He'll give you the seeds, let you use his horse. But you have to do the work because they needed your labor. And at the end of the year, based on how well you produce, you can have earned your care during that year, and you might get a profit of any profits that are left over. And guess who kept the books? Kept the books, and never did black folk ever break a profit. They never broke a profit, then most of them not only didn't break a profit, but see, and they couldn't protest, but if they talked back, then whites could have them arrested on those black codes for being insolent and talking back to white folk. And then after once they did that, he was criminalized, then he didn't have to pay him anything. And so when that happened, by 1869, 1870, most of these blacks were frozen all across the South again, locked back into slavery. And the United States government had participated in it again. Participated in all these corporations. And they wouldn't give black folk land, even the simple 40 acres and a mule. And keep in mind that in 1862, the last Homestead Act was passed in the United States. The last Homestead Act was passed in 1862, which means all those 11 million white immigrants I told you about a few minutes ago started coming in between 1865 and 1880, and then the other 26 million that came in to the end of the year, all of them came in here to get land while they were running the shampoo on black folk. Running the sham and game on black folk. As a matter of fact, in that period between 1862 and the turn of the century in 1900, the United States gave away 1 billion acres of land to whites. And black folk couldn't get an inch. Black folk did not get 1 inch of that out of 1 billion acres. As a matter of fact, the United States gave away more land to the United States railroads by giving them 6 miles on each side of the railroad across the United States. They gave them more land than there is in the entire state of Texas. And black folk couldn't get an inch for reparations. And you see, the game then was they locked black folk back in their labor and slave them again, and locked them in. And they needed us for consumers. And that went on. It went on. Let me jump up and show you how the game continues. We never got into reparations. And we still weren't free based on Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner's definition. And what they said as two white congressmen back in 1865 is that there's absolutely no way on earth black folk can ever be free and ever be emancipated unless you give them something where they can be in charge of their own lives. And that's never happened. Okay? And that's why if you look back right now, I'm telling you all, when I talked about what the Wall Street Journal said and what the Detroit News said at the outset a few minutes ago and what Alan Greenspan said, when you were almost 98% in direct slavery and 2% in indirect slavery, that means that 100% of all the black folk in America were enslaved in 1860. But even then, you had one half or 1% of the nation's wealth. And here you are 140 years later, when you're supposedly 100% free, you still only have one half of 1% of this nation's wealth. How can you sit there and talk about you're free and emancipated and all the game of shampooing going on? And even in modern day terms, when the white newspapers tell you that the shampoo is going, you still haven't gotten the black leaders right up there. Hold on a second, something's wrong. You can't keep tricking my people. As a matter of fact, when we get into reparations, I want you to have these arguments when people start telling you about why they oppose the reparation for black folk. One of the first things you're going to hear is that we oppose the reparation for black folk because we've already paid our dues. We fought the Civil War to free black folk. You didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. As a matter of fact, on the eve of the Civil War, in 1860, they'd already done a survey. They found out something like 99% of all the white people in America were opposed to freeing black slaves. Nobody wanted to free black slaves. 99% of all the whites in America were opposed to freeing slaves. Now, all of a sudden, 150 years later, after the fact, you can say, well, we fought the war for black folk. You didn't fight the Civil War for black folk. Just like it's the same little game, the same game of shampoo they ran on you after the integration. Now they talk about how segregation is so bad and how every white person was in favor of integration. When it's even as late as the late early 1970s, 87% of the black or the white folk in America in the 1970s were still opposed to integration for black folk in America, saying black folk were moving too fast and wanted too much. You see, every time there's a game, we get the shampoo. They run this same sham and leave the poo in. So now when you start talking about reparations, they can start